Angeles from the Grecian Garden and Emily Morgan from Nourishing Mama. All information shared on this podcast relating to specific conditions, health care, preventative care, and healthy lifestyles is presented for general informational purposes only. This podcast is for educational purposes only. Today, we will be speaking with Jen Chendia. Jen became a certified labor doula with CAPA in 2004 and is a certified childbirth educator with BirthWorks. She is a light to our community and has such a fun and unique personality that sends a clear message to others that it is okay to be you. Hey, Emily.
Hi, Melanie.
So what is new with you? Are you getting better? I heard you were sick for a little bit there.
Yeah, I had the flu last week, and surprisingly enough, taking my herbs and my garlic and my broth and let my body do its natural healing, I got well very quickly, and my kids did not get it.
Awesome. So what do you think helped the most?
For me, it was taking raw garlic shots. I did 4 gigantic cloves of raw garlic, and within 10 minutes of taking them, I felt extremely better. No more aches, no more, you know, fever and all of those things.
I know your immune system is probably so thanking you for just going through it and taking the healing stuff. And I mean, that raw garlic, I'm telling you, I got sick around the same time that you did. Maybe we passed germs back and forth. And for me, I'm telling you, it was the raw garlic and hot peppers. And I felt a shift when I did the raw garlic. That's just what helped me the most.
I think we probably could have kept the vampires away with all the garlic that we consumed.
Absolutely. We were all about the garlic. But today I'm so excited because we have a doula with us. And Emily, tell us a little bit about your birth experience.
Well, I've had 2 kids so far. My first one, both of them were pain-free. That's good. Drug-free, and I had a doula with my second one. She was actually a labor and delivery nurse, and she became a doula and helped me with my second child, and it was an amazing experience. She really, she helped me get through it, through the pain, and made sure everybody in, I was in the hospital, but everybody was doing what they're supposed to do, and I wanted certain people in, and had my wishes that I wanted for my birth. So it was a really good experience for me.
That's awesome. You know, I don't have kids, but I do have a niece and a nephew, and my sister does things pretty much on the same wavelength of thinking the way that I would, and we both kind of read a lot of the same books when she was pregnant, and the two that stood out to me the most, there was one book called Childbirth Without Fear, which was an amazing book about this man that he traveled to study birth in other cultures, and he would go to these women that were in, like, not in modern civilization. They were almost either in the jungle or in the forest or just away from modern society. When they would give birth, it was very quick. It didn't seem like they were in a lot of pain, and he would actually ask them, did it hurt? And this one particular instance, this woman said, was it supposed to? So he writes all about this idea of fear, that if we can go through the process of not being afraid and having more control, that it's going to be less painful. And then the other book that really stood out to me was a book called Supernatural Childbirth. And in this book, you more so say like daily affirmations, like letting your body know that it's in control and that your body can do this. And it was just, I mean, those are just 2 books that stood out to me.
Yeah, you know, having kids can be a little scary, but if you're knowledgeable and if you have the right people to surround you and you know what you want, then it can be a really great experience. With that being said, Jen, what inspired you to become a doula? Because there's so many different paths, you know, one could have taken. So what inspired you?
I think since I was a teenager, I had the childbirth bug. I was in college and looking through the library, kind of wondering if I really wanted to be an art major, you know, and I found this book that had something I'd never seen before in all my, you know, modern experience, which was just pictures of this crazy hippie lady giving birth kind of in a cabin. and it just lit a fire in me, and I went off to midwifery school as soon as I got my bachelor's degree, And then I spent a semester there, and during that semester, I got my doula certification, or I got the doula training. And then my path went a different direction, and I married my husband and left school, and that's when I became a doula. And I doulaed until my son was born. And then I took a long hiatus. He's 8 and a half now, and I'm moving back into it. But what really inspired me was not the first times I was a doula, I was kind of a student. And then after I had my son, and in the next 8 years, I learned that there was a lot to learn on the forefront of making childbirth easier that even as a student midwife and with all the education I had, I didn't know. And that's what really propelled me now is that there is so much information that needs to be out there.
Wow. So you've really done a lot of research and there's just so much out there. And it's so great that women have you to help them with their births. And as a doula, what really is your role during your client's pregnancy and birth?
So a doula's real, the heart of the doula's role is to go with the woman to the place where she's laboring and where she gives birth. And she may labor at home and then go and finish her labor and birth in the hospital, or she may labor and birth in the hospital or labor and birth at home. And the doula's role is to be a continuous presence, a layer of support there the whole time, even through the transitions of moving from home to hospital or the transitions of the hospital staff changing. She's got that doula there who she knew in pregnancy and who she's shared her desires for birth with. And that doula is there to help her as she goes into an altered state of being, which is what we really do when laboring, to continue to navigate healthcare decisions. The doula doesn't make decisions for her and doesn't do any clinical things like catheters or IVs. The doula is just there for emotional support.
I know that with my doula, when I was in the hospital, she kept everything very calm and quiet. And I know things can get very chaotic when you get to the hospital, especially, you know, this day and age where they want to pop those babies out as quick as we can get there. But have you ever experienced any, like, negativity from any doctors or anybody in the hospital setting, because it is kind of it's not really a normal thing to have doulas in labor and delivery these days.
Mm-hmm. There definitely is that element that I think there's a lot of defensive medicine being practiced and a lot of fear that as a physician, if I were a physician, that I might be sued or that I might be criticized or that my control may be interrupted by a doula. And I think that there has been some of that, gone on with doulas somewhere. And so there's some defensiveness. But I think a good doula and somebody who really feels confident and really has boundaries, that I'm not here to be the medical practitioner, I'm here as an emotional support person, can really ease a lot of those fears. And the more great doulas who are out there just doing a great job and really impressing the medical staff, like I think all the doulas in this area do, the more we'll have a good relationship with the medical staff.
I'm so glad you mentioned emotional support for the birth mother, because there are so many factors that go into pregnancy, as you know, but just having that emotional support of someone who's kind of been there through the whole thing is such an important part of giving birth and being able to control your own birth.
Absolutely. Having another woman there to help a mom's partner know how to support her and to help her just feel calm that she is supported, it can mean the difference between night and day.
And Jen, you are so calm and you just have this way of being present and being in the moment. I think anyone giving birth could really benefit from getting a person like you or having you come to be at their birth. But you recently have been doing what you've been calling a birth story circle. And tell us a little bit about that and what can one expect while attending those.
Oh, those are the real, my favorite work. It's a little bit of a part, it's a part of a big training that I'm doing with Rebecca Thompson, who lives down in South Florida, about using the telling of our stories to heal overwhelming experiences that we've been through. And we've all been born, and we all have the imprints of our births that we live with, that the idea is that what has happened to us, we may not be able to remember it consciously, but before our conscious memory developed, we had implicit memory, and that affects how we live our lives. And when we go through birth again by becoming a mother or becoming a father, we also have big, overwhelming experiences. And in our culture, we don't really support moms and dads in talking about it. That's what we do at birth story circles. We get together once a month, and it's free, and it's very relaxed, and we just tell what's going on for us. Sometimes we talk about birth, and honestly, sometimes we don't. Sometimes we talk about landlords and money and jobs, and that's okay, too. But I'm more and more and more, I am doing more sessions individually and these public sessions talking about what do you need to heal from this story? And I'm here to listen. And that's profound. It sounds simple, but it can be so healing.
Yeah, and one thing I remember you mentioning to me is you mentioned the baby, we're all delivered. And the baby could be going through something, and sometimes we have to acknowledge what the baby went through. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah. Well, the really amazing work that I do, I definitely do work with moms and telling their stories. And what I'm learning to do with Rebecca Thompson, who's amazing, the work is based on the work of Ray Castellino, who found that if we let babies do the birth crawl, which means that they are on mom's belly, and they can, no matter how young they are, crawl themselves up to the breast and self-attach. What they will do in that is they will show us their story by the way that they move and the sounds that they make. And as they're making those motions, we are telling them the story of their birth. And at first, I thought, this can't be true. I mean, this doesn't make any sense. How can babies understand what we're saying, let alone communicate to us? But I have seen over and over again that not only can they cry when we talk about how hard it was for them to get out and the mom pushed for 4 hours, you know, and they're crying as we're telling that. And then they cry and we say, when the mom gets to a point where she goes, you know, that must have been so hard for you. The baby quiets and then can attach to the breast and nurse, and breastfeeding difficulties are resolved, colic is resolved. The baby has felt heard. And I think that's a basic human need we all have, is to sit around a fire, you know, or whatever, at the end of the day and go, this is what happened today. Do you hear that? This is what happened. It was amazing. It was overwhelming. And now I feel better that I told you. I think babies can do that.
That's amazing. I'd love to see that in action.
Oh, you will. It's happening.
Is there a particular birth story that stands out in your mind? And it could be your own, just anyone that's very vivid.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this mom, one of the first moms I worked with doing this, we did this whole, this baby had a very normal birth, very natural birth, and that's what we often say, is that even a normal birth, no matter how gentle it is, it's overwhelming for everybody. And when something is overwhelming, we can process it by telling that story and integrate it, so that we feel comfortable with it again. So this baby's birth was just normal and simple. But at the end of this story showing session, which is what we call it, that's the work that Ray Castellino does. He calls it story showing. Mm-hmm. The baby just kept crying. And the mom had told the whole birth story, and this baby was just screaming. And the wonderful thing that I learned is that it's okay to let our babies cry. And I'm a breastfeeding advocate, and I'm an advocate of not letting our babies cry. But what I learned is that sometimes we don't just have to shove a boob in their mouth. We can just say, I hear you crying. And what this baby taught me was that this baby was there at the breast and could have just turned her head and latched on and nursed. But she wanted to tell us what it was like for her. She was just screaming and crying, and the mom starts crying, and she said, you know, what's coming up for me and what I'm hearing is that your father's brother died 2 weeks before you were born, and you came into this family while we're grieving, and that is so huge, and you must be feeling that. And the baby quieted and latched onto the breast. And just the idea that, of course that baby feels what it's like to be in the family. Everyone's emotions are heightened and grieving in the family. And hormones are being shared and hanging around, and everybody's feeling this way. And this baby comes into this family. Why would we even think that a beautiful, sensitive new soul wouldn't feel that? And that baby went on to nurse well and is a peaceful, sweet baby, but just needed to kind of feel like, yeah, that's what's going on. Now I understand, you know?
What a beautiful story. I mean, it's just, it's amazing because everyone wants to be heard. Everyone wants to be loved. It just goes back to those basic human needs. And yet, why haven't we applied that to babies?
And historically, we have thought that babies don't have feelings, that, you know, people could operate on babies without anesthesia, or that babies don't have a consciousness until they're a certain number of years old. And we've learned, obviously, that that's not true.
Yeah. Wow. Now, Jen, can we talk a little bit about a placenta encapsulations?
Let me
back up and ask that. So, Jen, tell us a little bit about placenta encapsulations and why someone would want to do that.
So first, I should say I did it both times. I had my placenta encapsulated, and I took it as pills, as a medicine, and it's a powerful medicine, I think. We don't have a lot of firm research, and I'm very science-y in general, so I like to see research, but the idea, which makes sense to my brain, is that there are a lot of nutrients in terms of iron and protein and hormones and other chemicals that somehow a mammal postpartum needs to have, and that all other mammals, almost all other mammals, consume their placenta after birth in some way. And that's really gross to us. So we encapsulate it. And traditional Chinese medicine holds that the placenta is a powerful medicine for anyone, but also for a postpartum mother.
Wow.
That's what that's all about. There has been some speculation about if it's, there's a theory called the fire hypothesis, and I'm trying to think of how to make that small and talk about it. The idea is that maybe there's a reason why historically throughout most of all of written human history, we have not done that. And the theory is that animals who live in the wild, all other mammals, consume their own placentas. And in some point in our history, we also did. But when we became basically domesticated, we began to spend more time around fire. And that increased the amount of things that we inhaled, toxic things, the smoke from the fire, and that was filtered by the placenta because that's its function, to filter the toxins and keep them there. And that then when the placenta comes out after the baby is born, then it contains those toxins that our bodies filtered because we were around fire when other mammals were not. And that those toxins make it not safe for us to eat, which is why universally throughout history, our cultures have had a prohibition against eating the placenta. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yes.
I've done some research, and I am going to post some blog articles about this. I've done some research that show that it's perfectly safe, that unless you're living in, you know, a coal mine or really awful conditions, that the levels of mercury and other chemicals are not higher than accepted safe standards for food and drink that we would normally eat. And so I believe it's perfectly safe. It's more work than I can do to do encapsulation and all the other things I'm doing. And I really wanted to focus on storying. So knowing and feeling safe that there are some people that I love in this area doing placenta encapsulations, I stopped doing them. Not because I think it's unsafe, but because of all that stuff I learned, and concurrently I'm busy with other things.
That was going to be my question.
I still will do homeopathic preparations, which I think are great, and I have one. They're easier, simpler to do, so maybe that's why.
So that was going to be my question was, who does the placenta encapsulation? Is it you, or is it somebody in the, you know, locally that you recommend, or how does that whole process, do you ask for it when you leave the hospital? I mean, the doctors might look at you kind of funny.
So it's a couple of doulas in town that I know. There may be more people doing it, but, and we have a beautiful, wonderful community of doulas. Holly Heller and Amber Roman are two that, as I know of, the only two that are doing placenta encapsulations. And you contact them before, hopefully a couple weeks before your due date, and they will have paperwork for you to sign, and, you know, that gives you all the information about what you need to provide to them. They'll give you a cooler that you take to the hospital with you, or you keep at home if you're having a home birth, and then they will come pick up the placenta as soon as possible after the birth, and then get the placenta pills to you within 3 days. We could do a whole session on placenta encapsulation.
We might have to.
Yeah, Amber would be a fabulous resource. I mean, Amber and Holly both. Amber taught me how to do it, so she has a lot to say.
Amber Roman. Yeah.
Amber Roman. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Awesome. And so I had heard, I don't know if you had ever recommended this before, but my sister had a midwife, and she always told her if there was problems with bleeding that after the birth that they would give her the placenta and make sure to give it to her. I'm not sure if you concur with that.
I haven't researched, so okay. I can't say one way or the other whether there's scientific evidence showing that it causes the uterus to contract, but that is in the old midwives' tales. And in anecdotal evidence I've heard, that can very quickly cause the uterus to contract, just taking a bite of the placenta, a little piece, and chewing it and swallowing it, or putting it in a smoothie or something. And saying that sounds great. I don't know if I could do it. You know, having been around a lot of placentas, it doesn't seem like a tasty thing.
Right. Yeah, I've seen some recipes for, like, placenta smoothies or placenta meatloaf, and the easiest thing to me almost sounds like the tincture.
Yes, that's what I loved. I have a tincture, and I really like the idea of a homeopathic tincture. And it's great because you use a small part of the placenta, like a tiny portion, and then you can bury the rest under a tree, or you can encapsulate the rest. You could have both a homeopathic tincture and capsules, which I got from my second baby. And so I still have that homeopathic tincture, which is supposedly, and again, there's no science on this, no research, you know, but supposedly it can be a resource for me, and I can keep it my whole life and continue to make homeopathic preparations from it, even for when I'm in menopause or for my daughter, whose placenta it came from. And it doesn't contain any placenta in it, so there's less ick factor, you know.
Yes. Yeah. Interesting. Well, we're just going to totally change the subject.
Go right ahead.
Yes, from placenta encapsulation to menu planning, because I know you cook for your whole family. And so tell us about your menu plan system and why you menu plan and how it helped your family.
It's so interesting that you would ask that, because I recently simplified it a lot.
Oh, cool.
I just will say I live with my husband and my two children and my parents, and in my family we have several people who are gluten-free and dairy-free. We have a couple of vegetarians. We have a couple of very picky eaters. There's some crossover in that. We have some people who like to have meat on a regular basis. It's very overwhelming to cook for all these people. I can't just make a pot pie, you know. And so what I've recently done is I figured out, and I'm really moving more into working outside the home more this year, which inspired me to simplify more. What I've always done is for years, a friend of mine inspired me to have every day is a different theme. So for us, I'll just tell you what we have. On Monday, we have Mexican food. On Tuesday, we have Italian food. On Wednesday, we have Asian food or a crock pot meal. On Thursday, we have soup. And some people in my family don't like to have soup when it's very hot out. So alternatively, we'll just have salad. Friday, we have pizza, whether it's gluten-free, dairy-free pizza, or Papa John's, unfortunately. Saturday we have burgers, which means veggie burgers, turkey burgers, and beef burgers, sometimes all on the same night because there are people who won't eat some of the others. And then on Sunday we have, I call it salad bar night, but it's we get out and make all the fixings for salad, and we have a salad bar set up, and then we take out all the leftovers. And you can have salad and whatever leftovers there are. Or if there aren't a lot of leftovers, I'll just bake a chicken. And what I recently did is I decided, you know, we can just have basically the exact same thing every Monday, you know, because basically Mexican food is just some kind of tortilla and lettuce and some kind of ground meat or meat substitute or tofu or whatever. And then you either make a burrito or a taco, and everybody can just make their own, you know. And then Tuesday, we basically just have pasta with, we have one kind of vegetarian meat crumbles, and they're by Qorn, Q-U-O-R-N. And they satisfy everybody's dietary needs. There's no gluten, there's no dairy, there's no meat. So we'll have that in red sauce with pasta. And so I've made it possible to kind of just simplify way down while being able to bring in the vegetables are different, you know, or maybe we're going to have a different pasta shape, or maybe, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And that has helped a lot. But, and then we do that with breakfast too. So, breakfast is the same. Monday we have milkshakes and muffins. Tuesday we have toast and eggs. I don't eat toast anymore because I'm gluten-free, and I don't like gluten-free baked goods. Wednesday we have waffles. Thursday, toast and eggs again. Friday, we have pancakes, but because everything goes with the day, you know, Tuesday toast, it's Fran cakes. My kids call it Fran cakes. And then Saturday and Sunday are kind of like whatever, you know. I like to make my eggs with avocado and all that.
Yeah.
Whew, menu planning.
Yeah.
I just got through doing my menu planning. Yours seems a lot more difficult than mine is.
Oh, I think that about yours. I look at yours and think, oh.
So,
but,
it's
challenging.
My last question is, if you are doing the cooking, who is cleaning up?
Oh, well, you know, I really... I really do a lot of it. My husband helps, and actually my parents help too, and we just started a great new... You're asking all the right questions. I got so tired of doing dishes because when it froze a couple weeks ago, our hot water heater stopped working, and so we couldn't use the dishwasher. So I spent 2 hours one morning doing dishes, and I was the whole time thinking, I've got to think of some better plan than this. This is ridiculous. So I realized if everybody just had one dish, and I heard this before, had one dish, and they took it to the sink after the meal, washed their dish, and took it back and set it on the table, that would eliminate, you know, having to wash 20 plates.
That's a great idea. For
3 days.
Amazing,
you know?
Idea.
And that's helped a little bit, but then there are pots and pans. And the fact is, if you cook at home, you just do a lot of dishes.
You do. Yeah. A lot of dishes.
Fortunately, my mom doesn't mind getting her hands in hot water and doing dishes once in a while, so...
Yeah, I think that's just great for real foodies. I mean, we're just going to have pots and pans,
yeah.
And we're going to have to do dishes,
yep.
And just have to recruit people to help, because in my house, typically, if I've been cooking for a long time, I'll have my husband help, but...
And that's the thing, if you've been cooking a long time, and then you have to do a bunch of dishes.
Yeah.
I've often just thought, I'm just going to hire a dishwasher.
I want to hire a dishwasher. I'll feed them if they'll just come wash my dishes.
Yeah.
How do you do it, Emily? Do you wash dishes too?
Well, because I've done my new meal plan, I'm basically washing as I'm going. So as something's cooking, I'm cleaning up and going.
Mm-hmm.
But at night, I typically do it because I'm lucky and I don't have to do the laundry in the house. So that's the trade-off.
I wish I did that more. My mom has always told me, if you do a little bit at a time, Melanie, you won't end up with this mountain. So I think, we have learned so much from you, Jen. I feel like we just kind of peeled back one layer. So you just have so much knowledge and so much you can share with us. And we so appreciate you being available to talk with us. And we encourage everyone to find Jen's website, which is Jen Chendea. J-E-N-C-H-E-N-D-E-A.net, or you can email her at jenchendia@gmail.com for more info about her or her services. And if you are interested in being interviewed on our podcast or have questions for us, please email us at thenourishingpodcast@gmail.com or check out our respective websites, thegreciangarden.com and nourishingmama.blogspot.com. This is Melanie and Emily wanting you all to live a nourished life. See you later, Jen.
Thanks, Jen.
Bye. Thank you.